יהיו לרצון אמרי פי בגיון לבי לפניך, אדוני, צורי וגואלי. May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. Shalom all and welcome to our classes here at the Kosher Torah School. I am, of course, your host, Ariel Bar Tzedok. And you find me, our school, our classes, our essays, our teachings, and all else related to Kosher Torah on our website. What else? www.koshertorah.com. We are in a class tonight where we are going to discuss the topic of what I call the universal way, what has traditionally been referred to as the path of the Noahide. And we're going to be reading from our textbook, Israel and Humanity, by Rabbi Elijah Ben Amolzeg, a book in English, readily available on Amazon.com. But before I get into the topic, I want to discuss something peripheral to it. When we talk about the concept, the idea of there being a commonality to spirituality, this is something which transcends all religion. We have made the point in our previous classes in the Israel and Humanities series that Judaism as a religion is, of course, a religion for Jews. And, needless to say, the road or path to conversion is open to all who wish to walk it. But Judaism does not portray itself to be the universal truth and, exclusive path to God. Such claims are made, of course, by Christianity and Islam. But Judaism, no. Judaism has always held that the commandments and the ritual observances thereof are the Jews' way of expressing their spirituality. But that underlying or transcending it, we said there is a universal path. Rabbi Ben Amolzeg in Israel and Humanity has always pointed to the Jewish mystical traditions to try to validate the existence of this universal concept, this universal understanding of spirituality. And you do find it existing in what we call the Kabbalah. Now remember, when I use the term Kabbalah, I am specifically referring to the metaphysical philosophical systems that arose out of Spain in the 13th and 14th centuries. I'm certainly not referring to the earlier traditions, which are referred to as the secrets of the Torah, or for that matter, the original, what we called Kabbalah or reception, which were the actual teachings of the biblical prophets. The earlier schools dealt with a very different understanding than that was developed later by the metaphysical philosophies called today Kabbalah. So, under such circumstances, again, it's always important to define terms. Rabbi Ben Amolzeg goes back and forth between the metaphysical philosophy, which we call Kabbalah, and the original earlier teachings. He does not make the distinction that I am making now, because he doesn't have to. But for us, where we are today, where in which there's so much confusion, there's a tremendous amount of confusion as to what exactly is Judaism. There is a tremendous amount of confusion today as to what is Kabbalah, and certainly a tremendous amount of confusion as to what is called Noahideism. In Judaism, as we said, there is this universal path. Unfortunately, many who look to Judaic teachings at a very superficial Platonic level, without understanding the true depth and essence of their meaning and nature, completely miss the point and they've elevated the universal path of Noahidism into a very focused and almost ritualistic Noahide religion. And people have gone so far as to try to present Noahide prayer books, Noahide rituals, Noahide groups, and the like. For the most part, most of these groups today are nothing other than anti-Christian, Christian bashing groups. It is most unbecoming and unfitting. Obviously, there are theological differences between Judaism and Christianity. That is a no-brainer. We all know that. And after 2,000 years of doctrinal and theological debate between the faiths, we are certainly no closer to any kind of theological reconciliation. And indeed, there's just not going to be one. It just is the way it is. So under the circumstances, rather than seek to try to build or cement differences that cannot be joined, ultimately we try to seek understanding and insight. Now, here in our Kosher Torah school, our job, of course, is not to pursue insights and understandings into Christianity, other than within the context of our context here, and we've already done that in previous classes. But we must understand that the universal teachings of what is called Jewish mysticism, the secrets of the Torah or the Kabbalah, have long been of interest to individuals far beyond the borders of Israel and Judaism. In other words, the universal message which Rabbi Ben Amol Zeg is speaking about here in the middle of the 19th century was certainly something understood and pursued centuries, if not millennia, beforehand. Now, Rabbi Ben Amol Zeg, he brings down examples from Talmudic times, how in the days of the Roman Empire, the universal message of Judaism proliferated then. But I want to take you centuries into the future. I want to help you understand with an exact example, a very profound book, which I recently became aware of myself. And I'll tell you the story. Last week, which time dating us here, was the intermediate days of the Passover holiday, Chol HaMoed. And I was driving one evening, listening on the radio to the BBC World Service. And they had a history lesson about a woman scientist in 17th century England by the name of Margaret Cavendish, who was the Duchess of Newcastle. She was a very interesting woman who had her own scientific ideas and beliefs. I believe, according to what I listened to, she was the first woman who was gained entry to the British or English Academy of Sciences. She was a contemporary and associate and friend with many of the greatest scientific minds of her day. So she was up there in the scientific world. But yet, what she is known for is a very curious novel that she wrote. And the radio program spoke about this novel of hers. They called it the first science fiction novel ever written in 1666. The story of the novel is very curious. It begins with this beautiful woman being kidnapped and taken on a boat up into the North Pole, where due to the cold weather, everybody on the ship dies except her. And then all of a sudden, she passes beyond the poles into a very warm, almost tropical environment where she meets all different kinds of humanoid life forms who are almost half human and half animal. And after a long story we'll make short, descriptions of this inner world and this domain, she finally meets the emperor of this domain and is made his empress. And the story then teaches about the nature of her exploration for wisdom. And again, this story is considered to be novellic, a made-up story that the Duchess makes and teaches, according to the interpreters, as a projection of her own wishes and thoughts and ideas. Well, that's all well and good. But there are elements in this story which, from my point of view as a rabbi, aware as I am of what we call the true secrets of the Torah, sounded very, very familiar to the point of being suspiciously familiar to me. The journeys described here by the Duchess do not sound like a flight of fancy into fantasy, but sounds more like a curiously very accurate description of a journey into what we call the hollow earth, the inner earth. The description of all these half-man, half-animal species is curious because Rabbi Avraham Azulai, in his book Hesed LaAbraham, in the 1600s, writes about the existence of such beings. And in all due respect to the good Duchess, I do not think that she would have had access to the Hebrew writings of Rabbi Azulai to have been aware of his ideas or revelations and then to have copied them into her work. So the question therefore remains, where did these fantasical ideas of her come from? She might have just made them up. That's true. Curious then how her fantasy corresponds and correlates to what Rabbi Azulai teaches are the realities of inner earth. And then she proceeds to describe this inner domain, how it has no night, but a continual sun, and how they traveled by a boat that did not have sails, but could suck in the wind from before it and blow the wind out in the back. Curiously, what I believe today we would call jet engines in the 17th century, 1600s. How curious. And all of these curious inner earth similarities. Again, I'm looking at, but I have to be honest, I look at it in the eye of the skeptic. And I look at it with the eye to be analytical. And I questioned myself to say, I wonder if she knows about Kabbalah. Well, I didn't have to wait too long to get my answer. Because as the readings proceed, she calls upon the spirits, all right? Here, the empress asked the flymen whether it was possible that she could become acquainted and have conferences with the spirits. They answered, they did verily believe she might. Hereupon, the empress commanded the flymen to ask some of the spirits, would they be pleased to give her a visit? And this they did. When the spirits had presented themselves to the emperor, in which shape and form I cannot exactly tell you, etc., and so on. But they go on and have a discussion. But she has curious questions to ask the spirits. Spirits, eh? Who are they? In the Islamic tradition, they'd be called the jinn. In the Hebraic tradition, they would be called ruchot. I do not call them shedim. You'll notice that because it's very curious the significances between them for another time. But now she asks whether there were none that had found out yet the Jews' Kabbalah. She wants to know what the spirits know about the Kabbalah. Right there, black and white, no beating around the bush. Then the empress asked the spirits whether there was a threefold Kabbalah. And they answered, right, some have made a twofold Kabbalah, Old and New Testament, but others might not only make two or three, but three score Kabbalahs, if they pleased. The empress asked whether it was traditional or merely scriptural, whether it's literal, philosophical, or a moral Kabbalah. Some answered, and they said they believed it was merely traditional, others scriptural, some literal, some metaphorical. But the truth is, they said, was partly one and partly the other, as partly traditional, partly scriptural, partly literal, partly metaphorical. Then the empress asks further whether the Kabbalah was a work only of natural reason or of divine inspiration. And they say, again, many said the spirits that write Kabbalahs pretend to divine inspiration, but whether it be so or not, does not belong to us to judge. On and on and on it goes with this very curious discussion of these different types and natures of Kabbalah, the likes of which we do not find in the Zoharic Spanish metaphysical tradition, but clearly in the earlier traditions. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with the growth and development of metaphysics in Renaissance Europe, there was a tremendous amount of interest in this type of spirituality. It was even given the name the occult. And it was a very, very popular course of study amongst many of the noble houses and leaders throughout Europe. And in spite of all the anti-Semitism and everything else going on, there was a tremendous amount of interest with rabbis in the noble houses. Many of the ancient works were translated into Greek and Latin. Certainly, Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed had been around since the 13th century. And you had many church fathers who embraced it, learned it jealously to reveal its secrets. Books like the Sefer Yetzirah and older texts were very, very well known. The point is, while the Duchess of Newcastle, Margaret Cavendish, in her book, The Blazing World, writes that this is all a novel, there is a tremendous amount of information in this, in quote, novel, which, in my opinion, puts it squarely into the proper context of being inner world, hollow earth genre. And for those of you who are listening to this class live, you will see that in the handouts section of this forum here, I've actually uploaded a full PDF version of The Blazing World. And I will encourage you, dabble a bit. It's written in Elizabethan English, but you'll be able to work your way through that. And the insights and revelations there echo that which we have been talking about, the universal path. Because I'm sure the Duchess was certainly a good Christian woman, but yet saw an element that was transcendent of her religion and ours. She was not pursuing Judaism. She had no intentions of becoming Jewish or converting, but recognized that there was something deeper. And it's that depth that is lost and misunderstood today by all the world religions. And that in itself, in my opinion, is one of the worst spiritual crimes prevalent today. People look so superficially that they refuse to look beneath the surface to get to the true essence of things. And ultimately, we are all familiar with the biblical messianic prophecies, that what we call the messianic age, there will be one world religion, one truth, one knowledge, which the Duchess, again in her book, says in the inner earth, there was a true knowledge and understanding, one religion. Well, maybe that's the religion we're going to learn someday when we put all these differences aside. And that indeed is in the process of happening today. We are right now in a very interesting position, a time in history. And I don't know if I will call it prophetic or whatever. I'm not going to wax doctrinal theological here, but let's get real. For the first time in known history, we have a global world. Everybody is in touch with everyone else through the internet and every other which way of communication. Well, right now in this online class, we have students joining us from at least 12 different time zones, 6 different countries on different continents around the world. And needless to say, those who listen to this recording and our other recordings literally are global. That is why our school has no real attachment to or association with our physical location. Our location is the World Wide Web. We are here for you, and we are together because we share the commonality of spirit. And that is who and what we are. But now, this did not exist in 1916, certainly not in any other time before that that we are aware of. What will things be like in 2116? I'm pretty sure I'm not going to be around to be able to look at it from this angle, meaning in the body on Earth, maybe from another point of view, from spirit, possibly, but those things are not in my domain or concern at this time. But here we are now. We are being mushed together in a global community. I don't think that's bad at all. Even though in the nature of our global community, we find a clash and the crash of cultures and civilizations. We see that happening now. We see the, aside from just the extremist Islam, we see extremist Christianity, we see the Dominionist movement, we see extremist Judaism. And all of these people whose only agenda is, the only word we can define it, is unnatural. Because it seems to be natural that we are being brought together. And they are violently, whether that be in the emotional or physical sense, resisting this concept of being brought together by ripping and tearing things apart, provocation, violence, and the rest. Nature is against them. Prophecy is against them. Somehow or another, we will graduate into, oh, and I know some people don't like this term, but I will use it, a new world order. No, not one that's going to be led by the devil in disguise or any other such nonsense. Nonsense. We have no such concept. Even in the Jewish tradition, in the beliefs of the character called Armilos, who the Christians call the Antichrist, and that actually is a quote from a Midrash, a Jewish work. Surprisingly, I heard recently of a Jewish rabbi who, when asked by Christians, is there such a concept of the Antichrist in Judaism? He said, emphatically, no, there's no such thing. And I was rather shocked. that he was ignorant of, unaware of the very, very clear black and white references to these things. Like I mentioned earlier, it's a shame when people who are supposed to be representative teachers lack sufficient knowledge and information, and therefore represent and project incorrect knowledge. In my opinion, that's most unbecoming. But getting back to the concept here of universality, Rabbi Ben Amozeg, in his book Israel and Humanity, needless to say, is centuries ahead of his time. Margaret Cavendish in The Blazing World is only an echo of other interests throughout Europe, whether it was Frederick of Prussia, Catherine of Russia, or many, many others. Certainly Isaac Newton of England. You do know he was a student of Bible codes and Kabbalah and mysticism. Many people do not like to expose that side of the great scientist, but it was there. And that's it. So, the whole concepts that we refer to in the Bible, somebody is making a mention here of the great war called Gog and Magog. And the problem with reading the prophecies of Ezekiel's great war is for all too long, people have interpreted this to be something to be happening literally, militarily, physically. Where in which the great rule of prophecy that's been made clear for centuries is that prophecy is occur in a dream and in a vision. And all dream and vision language is symbolic and metaphorical. So that indeed the great war of Gog and Magog and Armageddon, or for that matter, the character of Armilos, might not be a physical, political, or military reality at all, but only expressions of psychological turmoil, conflict, and eventual resolution, symbolized, metaphoricalized, in the mind of the prophet, in the words of the prophecy, in these symbols thereof. So for those of you apocalyptic types who want so desperately to see the end of the world, who want World War III, nuclear war, you are crazy. In my opinion, going against the stream of collective human consciousness, a danger to the future of humanity. And needless to say, there are no shortages of such nutcases amongst Jews, Christians, Muslims, and other groups around the world. We pray that truly there is a God in heaven, and that he may save us from these who are trying to act in God's name. What does it actually now mean to be a Noahide? Well, I am a Noahide. You are a Noahide. Because the term Noahide in its original biblical and rabbinic context refers to all what we call the children of Noah. And indeed, the Hebrew term for Noahide is Bnei Noach, children of Noah. And that means, by biblical standard, all of us. Because according to the Bible, the Torah, the stories that we hold as our faith, all mankind was wiped out with the exception of Noah and his children. And therefore, rather than refer to ourselves as the Bnei Adam, children of Adam, we are now all the Bnei Noach, or the children of Noah. That is where the term comes from, and that is what the term really means. So therefore, when our rabbinic sages make a reference to the Bnei Noach, they are not referring to a special group of specific people. Translate or retranslate that word as human being. And yet, in many a case, the term Noahide has been referred to as what in the Jewish tradition would be called the righteous Gentile. Now, this is important because the concept of the righteous Gentile, what we call the Talmudic concept or code, which is referred to as the seven laws of Bnei Noach. Now, the seven laws, like the Ten Commandments, are just a number. In literature about the Noahide teachings, you will find that the actual number of, in quote, commandments go far beyond seven in number. They go into dozens, if not hundreds, because it's not a ritual which is called upon for the world to observe, but rather a code of morality, honor, and dignity, which encompasses so much. These concepts, these foundational understandings, are ancient. We find them in ancient Jewish literature, Josephus, Philo, and surprisingly, even in early Christian literature. There is a very famous story in the Christian book of Acts, wherein which many non-Jews were being brought into the original Nazarene Nozri movement. Now remember, as we discussed in our Orthodox Rabbi Reviews the Gospel of Matthew series, which again is available for free in our Honor System Library online at koshertorah.com, we understood that the historical Yeshu, the historical Yaakov, James's brother, started a political movement with the specific focused intent to create an armed insurrection in Israel with the intent to overthrow Roman authority. And in order to strengthen faith in their leader, according to the theory and beliefs, they concocted the spiritual side of a crucified and resurrected Messiah in order to inspire people to believe that their leader, as I've discussed in written literature, was indeed the incarnate of the spirit of the angel of God, the Metatron soul, and all the like. Again, you can go online into Kosher Torah's written library and look up the essay, The Secret Soul of Messiah. I've discussed all of that element in detail there. But anyway, getting back to the point here, many non-Jews who were attracted to the universal message of Torah in the days of the Roman Empire, a point that Rabbi Ben Amozik makes very clear, were needless to say attracted to this, in quote, supernatural guru, Yeshu. And they were willing to join the movement because psychologically they felt the turmoil within and unfortunately misunderstood, just like those do today, that the turmoil was more than psychological, that it was meant to materialize politically, militarily. And therefore they came swarming into the movement. And here you have these very rigid, ritualistic, superficial, observant Jews, most extreme, having all these non-Jews coming to join them. What do you do with them? Well, I guess you convert them and make them Jews. But that might be a level of commitment many were not willing to make. After all, you just needed them to, you know, be bodies in an army. And so, as the book of Acts makes very clear, the question was brought to the head of the group at that time, James, who was Yeshu's brother. And they asked him, well, what do we do with them? And if you look in the book of Acts, chapter 15, pretty much what James said is they do not have to convert to become Jews. Let them observe or embrace the universal path, which he gives some descriptions. Don't eat meat sacrificed to idols, etc., and so on, which we recognize as a rudimentary form of these basic universal laws, which have become defined as the seven laws of the human beings, children of Noah, Noahide. So therefore, this knowledge, these foundations were mostly all moral and righteous elements. And this was not lost in history. Oh no, not at all. Another group that embraced the Noahide universal path, complementary in time to the Duchess Margaret Cavendish, was a order, some call a secret society, which today we know as the Masons, the Masonic Order. And of course, the Masonic Lodge today is the target of all kinds of conspiracy theories. They're in league with the devil. They're taking over the world. They want to destroy this. They're with the Jews. And of course, the Jews and the Masons together are conspiring to do this and that and that and this. My gosh! And every imaginable conspiracy theory revolves around and targets these two groups. Needless to say, Jews, I don't think there's enough unity amongst Jews today to be behind any conspiracy theory. And the Masons, well, they attract conspiracy. they attract attention, even though they try not to. Over 20 years ago, I wrote an essay called Kabbalah, Masons, and the Founding of the United States of America, in which I documented in detail the influence of the founding fathers, who, for the most part, were Masons, and their influence, which they were inspired by the Noahide path and what we would understand as our mystical tradition, and how they materialized the biblical message passed down since, we believe, the days of Moses. And for the first time in human history, a society and a government was born to express the true Noahide path. Birth date, July 4th, 1776. And of course, I speak of the birth of the United States of America. And yes, we have erred along the path, and we're no longer so much true to that. That's true. I get that and understand that. But the concept that Americanism began, freedom, human rights, and the like, it's proliferating around the world. Each in different ways, in different countries, in different cultures. But what we see today proliferating was unheard of 100 years ago. Certainly hundreds of years ago. You see the progression? Now, a point that I made in my essay, and I'll quote it to you. It's from a 1723 book on Masonry called The Laws of Obligations, laid before his brother Masons by Prince Edwin. And I quote, "The first obligation is that you should sincerely honor God and obey the laws of the Noahides, because they are divine laws which shall be obeyed by all the world." This is something, 1723. Major Masons included Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, George Washington, first president of the United States. Indeed, in his inauguration for president, I believe in his second inauguration, he even took the oath of office in his full Masonic regalia. You can go online and Google the photo. Not the photo, actually, but the painting, you'll see. These symbols of the Masonic order meant something to these men. Because within these symbols were included the Noahide teachings, the Jewish mystical teachings. Now, I myself am not a Mason. And I have, in the course of my years of study, endeavored to learn about as much about them as I can from reading all the different books. And I see a number of our mystical teachings and rites. And indeed, in my essay on the Kabbalah, Masons, and America, I went into detail into the meanings, the mystical meanings within the Great Seal of the United States of America, wherein which it was specifically designed to represent these concepts and ideas. And again, for those of you who are with me in this live class, wherein which we have the handout sections, you will see that I've uploaded that PDF essay for you. You can take it and read it at your own leisure. For those of you who are listening to this recording, again, you can go on to our website, koshertorah.com. You will find the Kabbalah Masons. Just put in Kabbalah Masons, Masons America, and in our search engine for koshertorah.com, it will pop up. Now, with regards again to Margaret Cavendish's book, The Blazing World, you can find that readily available online, just like I did. Or you might want to purchase it in paperback and or hardcover. It's a very profound story. But okay, I've given you a background and insights into the true nature of the universal teachings. Rabbi Ben Mozeg goes to, or I should say, elaborates upon us the understandings of many elements and aspects which were observed in ancient times. In the days of Rome, before the insurrection which so poisoned the Roman Empire, the Roman civilization against Jews and Judaism, indeed, Judaism was a very attractive path. No, not that everybody was becoming converted to Judaism, but the universal message underlying it was very attractive to all. It spoke about human dignity, human rights. What is one of the most simple and basic human rights? The answer should, I hope, be clear and obvious, is that we all have worth. We all have value. We all have dignity. As such, when we observe the Sabbath is the celebration of human dignity. As we say, in remembrance of the creation, wherein which humanity celebrates our creation. What are we? We are not just mere animals. We are intelligent, thinking beings of light. And it's our minds which elevate and separate us from the rest. And when properly trained and developed, which again is the secrets of the Torah, enable us to rise to the full heights of materializing within us that which we call the image of God. And therefore we celebrate a Sabbath day, a day of rest, because although we must work, human dignity demands that we also must rest. It's a very controversial concept in the old world, because those who took a day off were considered lazy from work. Today, not only do we take a day off, we have a weekend. We have limits of how many hours we're supposed to work and all the rest. Show dignity Therefore, the observance of the Sabbath, not in a ritual way, but in a conceptual way, was well embraced even in the days of the Roman Empire. So therefore today, if there are those who wish to observe a Sabbath, if you are a halachic Jew, you observe the Sabbath in relation to the halacha, the specific ritual observances that we Torah Jews observe. But if you are not that, then you should observe the day in respect for what it is. And that's why we disconnect from the world. Turn off the phones, turn off the TV. A day for the rest, relaxation of the mind, where we're not overly stimulated and inundated and bombarded, where we can take time to think clearly, lucidly, contemplate the world, nature, ourselves, our family. That is what a Sabbath is all about. Rabbi Ben Amozeg brings down, very popular in those days. He continues to speak about what the Bible calls the God-fearers, the Yirat Shamayim, right? Those who feared God. Clearly, in biblical times, there were always those among the nations who are considered righteous, pious, decent, good individuals, who were, you know, holy people. Not really, you know, I shouldn't say holy, but righteous, right? It's good, decent people. Indeed, even in the book of the prophet Malachi, it says, from the rising of the sun to the going down thereof, great is my name amongst the nations. Because indeed, these universal concepts, these universal laws, were embraced by those who understood nature's way. They sought what we call monotheism. Or in other words, even as you see in the Taoist tradition of China, the concept of the singularity which unites all and directs all. Now, for those of you who might have some semblance of familiarity with Chinese ideas or philosophy, you might also be aware of something called the yin and the yang. No one should ever be so ridiculous to think that to be an idolatrous symbol or something. Certainly it's not culturally Jewish, but then again, who knows? Because the Jews of China certainly had cultural expressions different from those of the Eastern European model branch, which is popular today. The yin and yang concepts divided reality into two opposing forces. Just like in the early Kabbalah, they refer to the du partsufim, the dual worlds, light, darkness, good, bad, hard, soft. But yet, in the yin yang, these are not opposing forces at war with one another. If you're familiar with the symbol, it's a circle where each one is like the shape of a teardrop or almost like a fetus. One black, one white, with the black having a dot or spark of the white and the white having a dot or spark of the black. And the two together form a concentric whole to help us recognize that the appearance of duality is only superficial, and that underlying the movement is the singularity of the great way. And like in the Kabbalah, the Tao Te Ching, the words of the famous philosopher Lao Tzu said, that in his words, the Tao that can be named is not the eternal Tao, which means the universal way that we can put our finger on and define, that's not the universal way. Gee, we say the exact same thing about the Torah. The Torah is the universal path. The Torah is the concept of the Tao. the nature, the flow, the movement. When we see the singularity in the teachings, we build the bridges. We recreate the harmony. This is called Tikkun HaTorah, the rectification of the Torah. Because we say, in Kabbalah speak, just like the children of Israel are in exile, exile, remember, is a psychological concept. Exile from ourselves, exile from our true identity, exile from revelation, exile from enlightenment. We are also in exile from knowledge, from the source of that which we hold sacred. We look at the Word of God, which we call the Word of God, and we interpret it in every which way. And out of all of those ways, we never seem to get it right. And all these ways compete and conflict and fight with one another and create more and more division. Because the mind of the divisive wants to say one way and no other. Wherein which nature teaches us always, like spokes to the center of the wheel. And my way is not your way, and your way is not my way. We each have our own way. And this concept of pluralism, tolerance, and respect was put into words by a 16th century, 17th century Kabbalist, I believe, writing in the 1600s, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbi Naftali Bacharach, in his book called The Valley of the King, Emek HaMelech. And I've translated this section and printed it on our Kosher Torah website, wherein which Rabbi Bacharach states, based upon the ancient Talmudic teaching that there are 70 faces or interpretations of the Torah. Now, 70 again is just a metaphorical number. So don't go try to enumerate what they are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Again, you can't enumerate a metaphor. He says there are 600,000 interpretations at each level of biblical understanding, which we call in Hebrew Pshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod. So you do the math, 600,000 times 4, right? Over 2 million. In other words, what he is saying, 600,000 against the metaphorical number of the souls, which is the symbol of all the souls of collective Israel. And each individual soul has their own unique way of perceiving the universe or the Torah. I don't know there's a difference on the universal level. And that is part of this Noahide universal path. Understanding, respecting, seeking the unity, the common denominator, which connects to, binds us together. That is the great secret message of what Torah is really all about. And of course, the true message and meaning of what it is to be a Noahide. And therefore, Noahideism today is not a separate religion. It is not an anti-Christian or Christian bashing movement of ex-Christians. It is not trying to tell people, you got to believe like this and you got to believe like that. Seek Heil. None of that nonsense. None of that disgusting, perverted divisionisms. Nothing of the kind. It is universal. It is embracive. It is what we call the equality of all human beings. You see, unfortunately, even in Judaism today, as we know, there's a terrible amount of racism. There is those Jewish teachings, some from very popular sources, who actually say a myth, which is a racist myth, and I might add a fraudulent teaching, that there is something called a special Jewish soul, and it is superior to the Gentile soul. It is closer to the Gentile soul. And of course, the Gentiles only have what's called a nefesh behemit, or an animal soul. In essence, what these racists are saying. We're human beings and you're animals. Yeah, there are unfortunately racists like that in Judaism. But then again, in all honesty, you have racists like that in every religion, in every concept, doctrine, and theology. Our mission is to disavow and to separate from that. I've quoted from the famous Midrash called Tana Dvei Eliyahu on numerous occasions, wherein it's in the words of the prophet Elijah himself, where he calls heaven and earth to witness for him, that be it a man, male or female, Jew or Gentile, freeman or slave, all can receive Ruach HaKodesh, become like prophets, depending on one's behavior and action. Therefore, everybody's soul has equal opportunity. The difference between a Jew and Gentile is, if you will, the difference between men and women. No one is superior to the other, but different in purpose, different in function. And each to harmonize together, possibly symbolically, like the union of yin and yang, and joining together is the harmonic whole. That is the way Israel is to be a light to the nations, like Isaiah said. You see, the universal understanding was always there. And that's the attitude that we must take. And the definition of a, in quote, Noahide movement must be not one of a new religion, but one of universality for all humanity, seeking the common denominators that bind us in each and every form where it's to be found. And when we do this, then we understand. Somebody's asking, won't that lead to intermarriage? I don't know. Ask King David. Ask King Solomon. All right, they intermarried for good or for bad. Ask the many people who married non-Jews who converted. Nothing wrong with marrying a non-Jew, as long as for a Jewish point of view, that person joins the faith, because ultimately you have to raise children in a path. No, it's not going to lead to intermarriage. Why should it? Because ultimately, when a person embraces one's own path and is proud of it, and another has a different path, you can't mesh the paths together. Ultimately, people have to be respectful of their own. So if you wish to live a life of Torah Judaism, if you are male or female, and you find a partner who is not of that faith, and yet Torah Judaism is your path, then the partner who you choose, obviously, will have to embrace that path with you so that you can have commonality of life, purpose, raising your children. That's not intermarriage, might be conversion. Certainly today that is a controversial purpose because of the, I should say controversial path because of all the perversion going on in the communities today and the politicization. But what can I say? This is the future. This is where we're heading. And whether we like it or not, we will accomplish this. Because it is the path of nature, it's the path of the universe, it's the path of Torah, it's the path of God, it's the prophecy. Go read for yourselves. So on that note, we've talked about the universal way, the path which we call the Noahide. I want to thank you again all for joining me for this class tonight. Again, I'm your host, Ariel Bar Tzedok. Come see us online at koshertorah.com. Thank you again all for your support. And God bless. Good night. Shalom.